Hey y'all, I just recorded a 10-minute intro. It's just some updates on what's been going on in my sabbatical, updates from cohort 9, what's going on with cohort 10, reading some testimonials. There is a gift in there, so watch out for that. If you've been wanting to enroll in the self-paced masterclass, I encourage you not to skip through my very long-winded intro, but if you're already enrolled in the self-paced masterclass, if you're already certified and you just want to get to the interview, go skip like 10 minutes ahead and I will see you on the flip side. What's up, OEUXers? I have got a really fascinating conversation for you today with Kristen Olette Muscat, an experienced UX designer who has been working in the government space for years. She was actually on our OEUX and Government Happy Hour panel last year, so you might know her from there. And I have been meaning to have her on the podcast since she got certified as an OEUXer back in cohort 4, actually. So we will put the link to that Happy Hour panel as well in the show notes. But before we jump into this conversation about her experience using OEUX within this crucible of government consulting projects, I want to give you all a quick update on how January is going so far, my sabbatical, and what's coming in 2024. So as many of you might know, if you were on my newsletter, if you're not on my newsletter, OEUX.com/newsletter, and I'll get you a free 55-page OEUX launch guide, which is awesome. Anyway, if you are on my newsletter, you might know that I've been taking January off, or if you've tried to email me and gotten my what people have called an epic autoresponder, where basically I just tell everybody that I'm going to be deleting all emails in February. So you might know I've been taking January off for what I'm calling Whimsy January, which is this like anti-skill. I am training myself to not plan. I'm practicing not planning. This is a month to rest and reset and reassess and yes, prepare for a really epic 2024. But the only plan was to not make plans. The only plan was to wake up in the morning and decide what I was going to do that day. I feel like I've really just started that in the last week. So I had a visit from a dear friend that was actually pretty impromptu. So that was cool because I had the space to say, yeah, come stay with us for 4 or 5 days. So she was here up until like the first week of January. And then we had a ski trip planned. Some of y'all might know, Luke and I love our skiing. And That trip was planned like 6 months ago. So of course we went skiing, but I will say like, even with having a house guest here and going skiing, like I approached each day a lot differently. I really was trying not to plan and be spontaneous and just figure out kind of where the day would take us. So of course we were skiing on the ski vacation, but as far as like trying to get on the slopes by a certain time or, and then we planned some other things. Anyway, it was more whimsical. It was definitely more whimsical. Then we get back from the ski trip and both of us get sick. First, I get sick. I know everybody's been sick the past couple months. Oh my gosh. You might tell I'm still a little sick here. I'm just getting over it. But I got sick and then I finally gave it to Luke. So Luke's been sick. And it's really just been the last couple days where I've been able to be home, really have a whole lot of space and wake up and just decide what I'm going to do. And guess what I end up doing? I end up doing OEUX, kind of. I end up doing some really pointless OEUX, or not pointless, but something that I've been wanting to do. So we have all of these mushroom books. I'm like an aspirational mushroom forager. We also have some card decks on mushrooms, like 2 card decks. And I have been going through all this information and I've been trying to figure out the structure of identification of mushrooms and how mushrooms are categorized. And I've been kind of sort of trying to normalize the data. And it is not easy. I've been doing it totally analog. But common names for mushrooms are different. Even scientific names for mushrooms can be actually kind of confusing. They look different in different pictures because they're taken at different times or they're taken at different In different locations. Anyway, so I've been nerding out on that, but it's just so funny. This is what I end up doing. This is my play. But it really has been so interesting to practice this kind of anti-productivity skill. I don't know if I want to call it anti-productivity skill, but it's basically practicing following my energy, following my flow, keeping, I want my plans to become more loose, right? I am a chronic planner. When I started my business back in 2014, I didn't have these skills. And it wasn't until about 4 to 5 years into my business that I really learned how to plan. And I have taken it, the pendulum has swung far into the planning. I plan my days, I plan my weeks, I plan my months, I plan my years. So this has been quite therapeutic the last month of really trying to figure out how I loosen that up quite a bit and go with the flow and go with my flow and figure out where my energy is moving, because in a way you can become a lot more productive if you're not fighting the flow. And I'm really hoping to take a lot of these skills. I shouldn't say I'm hoping. And I am going to take a lot of these new skills and I'm going to bring them into February and beyond. And honestly, February is probably going to be pretty light as well, just because I really do feel like I'm just kind of scratching the surface of this, and I do feel like I need some more practice. I am going to be back in February, officially back in February, and I do plan on doing a new live training either at the end of February, the beginning of March, and I've got 3 ideas that have been percolating for years, and OAUXers are currently voting on those ideas over in the forum. Now, this is for folks in the self-paced masterclass that have enrolled in a past cohort. I'm only asking them right now because a lot of these things that I am going to be offering are going to be only for folks that have enrolled in the self-paced masterclass. So those are collaborative OAUX practice days, kind of like OAUX hackathons. That's one of the options. A advanced training is another option. And the third option that folks are voting on is a technical training with Notion, Airtable, and OAUX documentation. So if you have not gotten the emails on that, if you are in the self-paced masterclass or have enrolled in a cohort, then you are also in the masterclass. If you are enrolled in the masterclass, go to the forum, go to the OAUXer home base, check out that poll, and please give me your thoughts on what you want. All right. Finally, oh my gosh, okay, I forgot to mention, we wrapped up cohort 9. And I really just want to share a few of my favorite sound bites from the testimonials that came out of this group. And then I'm going to give you an update on cohort 10 and a gift. So stay in there. Don't skip ahead yet. Hang on. Okay, Rebecca W. said, going through the OAUX certification program was like being handed an organizer binder for my systems thinking brain. Instead of struggling to piece together all the interconnected bits and pieces visually, I now have a solid process and principles to help make sense of any digital system structure. Ambar said, tricky system architecture, hairy roles and permissions, arguing with product about requirement phases, I can use Orca to uncover clear user mental models, uncover research needs, and validate my research step by step with documentation that allows for phase development that's both manageable and scalable. I'm excited to implement this into my work and continue to nerd out with the new community, with this new community. Ambar, we are nerding out with you. Kyla B says, having completed the OAUX self-paced course and the certification, I've become much more confident UX designer. I now feel even more prepared to tackle complex problems, whether starting in the messy middle or from scratch. The OAUX methodology provides designers or anyone dealing with a problem, the vocabulary and strategies necessary to communicate and achieve a more user-centric solution that is easier to execute and ship. Pretty awesome, right? Thank you so much. And if you want to see all of those testimonials, go to OAUX.com/testimonials. They're all there. You can continue reading for days. So I really want you to know that so many folks in the certification, Kyla B not being the only one, say how glad they are that they tackled the self-paced masterclass first. And to clear up any confusion, you do not pay extra to start with the self-paced. Okay, there's only perks to doing this. Basically, you're doing it and you're doing the certification in two payments. First, you're going and you're getting all the materials, you're getting all the videos, all the templates, you're getting access to the community, but you're just not getting all the hand-holding that happens and all the mentorship and all of that high-touch service that happens during the certification. You're just not getting that yet, but you're getting onboarded to everything. Okay, so you can go ahead and you can enroll now in that self-paced masterclass. And then when cohort 10 rolls around, then you can upgrade and join cohort 10. All right, so cohort 10 is not happening till probably April is what we're looking at. So you're really going to want to go ahead and get started on the material as soon as possible. And then when you go and you join cohort 10, you can focus on the rigor of the certification. You'll be able to go deeper. You'll get more out of the certification. If you've already gone through most of the videos, perhaps already you've taken a design challenge through the process on your own time, you're going to be able to just dig in so much more during that cohort. Okay, and then after the recertification invites go out, those that are enrolled in the self-paced masterclass are going to get early access to those limited spots that are going to be in cohort 10. Okay, so we usually do not do this, but if you are listening to this, I know I've been talking for a while, so thank you for continuing to listen. I want to give you a secret podcast-only discount code for $100 off to enroll in the self-paced masterclass. This code is only good through February 9th of 2024. Okay, so are you ready? The code is OOUXPOD2024. And we'll put a direct link in the show notes. And again, that code is going to turn into a pumpkin on February 9th. We really don't throw out discounts like this often. Why? Because honestly, we're already underpricing this course. It is a 22-hour course, y'all, and you get lifetime access to this robust community of help and support for three figures. You can't get that. That's crazy when I think about it. And the skills that you're going to add to your repertoire are just going to pay dividends for your entire career. So I really hope to see you enroll in the course, and hopefully you're planning on grabbing a spot in cohort 10, and I will see you in late-ish spring. Okay, enough chit-chat. Let's go talk to Kristen. Welcome to the Object-Oriented UX Podcast, a podcast about tackling complexity head-on, gracefully organizing massive amounts of information, and designing scalable, future-proof, and of course, naturally intuitive object-oriented user experiences. An OUXer is a powerful blend of information architect, business analyst, facilitator, and UX strategist. If this sounds like you or what you aspire to, you are so in the right place. I'm Sophia Prater, UX designer, chief evangelist of Object-Oriented UX, and your host. Let's jump into it. Kristen Olette Muscat, welcome to the OUX podcast.
Thank you. So happy to be here.
Yeah, it's exciting. I'm really excited about the topic that we're going to be going over today. And I'm actually just going to read your bio because I love it so much. So I'm just going to read it straight, which okay. I usually don't do. So Kristen, this is Kristen's bio, y'all. As a writer, artist, and design leader, Kristen finds joy in bringing people together and creating in a way that respects the diversity of all life. She works efficiently at a sustainable pace across industries, disciplines, and levels of ambiguity. She centers lived experiences and the design of our shared future. She currently works as a civic technologist, strategist, and UX designer at Coforma, an ethics first technology and user research firm working for the public good. So that is, I can tell you're a writer. That's absolutely beautiful. But
thank you.
First, can you, can you tell me all about the sustainable pace thing? I feel like I need to know more.
Yes. So working in government, as anyone who has done that before will know, can be very taxing because of all the red tape, because of the kind of very slow pace at which things currently kind of go. So to not get burnt out in that environment and to really commit to like working for the public for like the entirety of my career, which is currently my goal, you gotta work slow and you gotta work at a sustainable pace and take time for rest. And this is something that is really important to Co-Forma, which is why I love Co-Forma. I think it's an awesome place. I'm looking at my little one of my Co-Forma stickers right now that says invest in rest. And yeah, so these are things that are really important to me. And so I wanted to put it in my bio because it's like essential to the way that I do work.
Did you have to learn that the hard way, or did you just go to Co-Forma and that became a principle? Did you kind of inherit that principle for them, or did you have to find your way to that principle?
Definitely found my way. I think I started my career working at, I worked at a nonprofit that was in college affordability, so trying to help students and families get financial aid for college. And the nonprofit space can be very the opposite of sustainable pace. You know, it can be like really fast paced. Everything is urgent. You know, the missions are always super important. And I worked, you know, I was, you know, recent college grad, so my work wasn't super essential, but I was working with folks that would work like 10 to 14 hour days, and it just didn't turn out well. Yeah, we don't need to go into the details, but yeah, I did learn the hard way, that for to have like a sustainable career, gotta take care of me first.
Definitely. Yeah. And that's something that I've been learning the past couple of years on. Actually, a lot of the content that I've been taking in has been anti-productivity content, on really kind of embracing, nodding to Oliver Berman, who wrote 4,000 Weeks, which I recommend to everybody who has productivity guilt. But basically, this idea that we're finite creatures and we need to embrace our own finitude, that we're not going to be able to do it all. And we're actually never going to be on top of everything. So just like being okay with that and, and not trying to like use all of these kind of techniques to sort of like fit more into the day, it's been really transformative for me. I realized like at the end of last year, I was like, man, I end almost every day feeling like I didn't get enough done. And that is no way to live. Like, I don't want to like look back on my life and be like, wow, I spent the majority of my time beating myself up for not getting enough done for some sort of like kind of arbitrary benchmark. So I applaud you in that. It is a hard thing to do in this world that we live in. So it's kind of ironic and kind of even counterintuitive that the pace of government is so slow that that can be exhausting. And I kind of think about like an exercise metaphor of like riding a bike slowly is actually sometimes harder than riding a bike, right? Like picking up a little bit of speed and getting momentum. Like that lack of momentum and the fits and starts of the work can actually be really exhausting. Is that
Yes, absolutely. And I was talking with my brother-in-law, he's in a poli-sci PhD program at Georgetown, so he's like interested in government as well. And we both had worked with CMS, Senator for Medicaid and Medicare, on projects recently. And we were just chatting, and I was like, we were talking about the meetings, and I was like, oh my gosh, there's always like 60 people on the meeting, and no one's cameras on, and like that type of social engagement can be really challenging. You know, day to day, when there's always like a million people you have to get approval from, the contracting, which I think we'll talk about later, it just makes everything so much more complicated. You can't just like do the work and talk to the people you need to talk to. Sometimes you have to like talk to like five people before you actually talk to like the person you need to talk to. And that stuff is like, so for me, I'm a very like, just do what I want, go for it type of person. And my first job in government, I worked as a fellow at the Library of Congress. And so I was a government employee, so I had to like do all the background checks and, you know, do my time and all of these things. And I hated it so much. I hated like the bureaucracy and having to like be in the bureaucracy. So now I really like being at Co-Forma, where we consult in that environment. So like my Co-Forma team and environment is very different than like how the government actually is. So it makes it easier for me to be able to like go into battle, you know, in the government space that's there. Not to say that the folks working directly for the government aren't like awesome and doing a great job. It's just, you know, time has created this very like morass of difficulty up in there.
There's this this term that I learned recently. Shout out to Marisa Montaldi, who taught me this term of shaving yaks. Have you heard about shaving yaks or yak shaving?
I think so, but tell me about it.
It's this idea. I don't, like, I forget the origin of it. But it's this idea that, like, for any task you need to do, often there's like a certain amount of like other tasks to get to the task. And like this guy that came, they just like named it. I don't know the history of it, but like he named it yak shaving. Of like, oh, it's just like you gotta like shave some yaks before you like actually get to the real thing. And I think working in government is one of those places where there's just a lot of yak shaving that has to happen to get to the actual task that you're trying to do.
Yes,
that it's so funny how like a reframe of that or just like naming a thing can actually be really can be really healing in a way of like, okay, like this is all this is. I'm having to reset my password and then do two-factor authentication just to do this thing that I'm trying to do to actually go do something else that I was trying to do. It's just a little bit of yak shaving. That's just life. You're going to have some yak shaving, but yak shaving in of itself is exhausting sometimes. And then you just have to take care of yourself when you realize that like, okay, today's been a lot of yak shaving. And that's often even harder than the actual work.
Yeah. And sometimes you need a TikTok for 30 minutes to an hour to get through that.
Yeah.
And no shame.
Yes. Whatever your resources happen to be to kind of reset yourself. There's TikTok. There's also just like going outside and putting your feet in the grass. That helps too.
Yes.
I found doing a little bit of grounding. So we're here to talk about object-oriented UX. And I was thinking like, I've been saying to people that OUX is a way to, and the Orca process is a way to slow down so that you can actually end up going faster in the long run. And it's like this like pause, or this space between doing research and then jumping straight into sketches or jumping straight into designs. Do you feel like, does that tie in at all to, do you feel like that's true, that it's been this way to like take a pause?
Yes, absolutely. I feel like I had a conversation in one of my previous projects that really kind of nailed down for me why OUX is so important. And we were talking about an MVP that we were trying to make. And I was trying to make the argument for taking a moment to pause and to like really figure out the OUX of the matter, you know, using different language to talk about that. And some of the stakeholders were like, oh no, like the MVP, like, you know, we're trying to build a house, but first we have to build a shack. And that was like the model that they had. And I was like, no, if I'm going to go build a house, I'm going to build a fucking house. I'm not, don't
yes.
make me live in a shack for a little bit of time.
Yeah.
So I think OUX is the way to figure out what do we actually need in our house? Like it is the architecture of the thing instead
right.
of starting with something that isn't what we're going to need ultimately.
That you're going to have to tear down. You're going to have to tear down the shack to make room for the house. So why not just like make a foundation, get like, make the house like, you know, give it some walls. Okay. We can move in with like walls and floors and like some good plumbing and some bare electricity. And then we can figure out later what color the walls
decor,
are going to be.
Exactly.
And like maybe add the porch on later. We don't need to put the porch on yet. And maybe even this like extra, we can just stub out this bathroom here right now. Like we know that there's going to be a bathroom here, but like we can move in with it just stubbed out. Like that's the better metaphor than let's build the
let's
shack,
start with
then
a shack.
Tear it down and then build like a slightly nicer shack. And then build, and then tear it down, and then build the bungalow. Even when we're actually like trying to build a hospital or something like that, like
right. And when we know, like, this isn't the first time humanity has ever built a hospital or built a website. You know, we know how to do these things. We have architects for a reason because they understand how to build like the foundational structure of buildings or websites. So totally.
Yeah. So in the long run, we can actually get to the hospital faster. If we just do a little bit of that planning up front, not too much, right? We don't need to do 3 years of it before we start working on something, but like, can we do a little bit of that Can we survey the land? Can we make sure okay, what kind of constraints are we actually working in? And then what are the basic needs and how do we get an architecture that will fit those needs? Because I use this metaphor, this is we're merging metaphors here, but I will often say that information architecture, you do not want to be iterating a lot on your information architecture. That is incredibly expensive. That is moving walls around. Mm-hmm. Iterate on where the furniture is. Maybe we know that there's gonna be a bathroom here, we'll stub it out, but you don't want to be constantly iterating on a quarterly basis on your core information architecture. That literally shouldn't change decade to decade, even. That shouldn't actually change. So yeah. So it is it's slowing down and making space and let's just be a little bit more deliberate about the work that we're doing.
And it does not slow down development. Only, so slightly, I think, does it actually slow down development to take a few weeks to a month to work on the OUX or something.
What's up, OUXers? There is something very important that I have neglected to do in the first 50 episodes of this podcast. And that is to implore you, dear listener, for a review. So here I am, asking ever so nicely for you to drop a rating and review of the OUX podcast into either Apple Podcasts or Spotify. This can really help us spread the OUX love. So if you've gotten any value from OUX and the Orca process, which I'm assuming you have since you're here, I'd be so appreciative for a few minutes of your time. Okay, so how to do this? Don't actually go click on the rating metadata because that would be way too intuitive. On Apple Podcasts, go to the podcast detail page, scroll to the bottom, and you'll see some big stars down there that you can add stars. And then underneath that, there is another little link that says create a review. So that would be amazing. And on Spotify, you've got to do this on the mobile. On Spotify mobile, go to the three-dot menu on that detail page and hit rate. And actually on Spotify, even on an episode detail, you can leave a comment there too. If you scroll down the episode detail, there'll be something that says something like, how did you like this episode? And feel free to put your thoughts there. Thank you so much and happy OUXing. And so you actually, so I have a lot of questions. So you were on our OUX happy hour government panel, and I kind of flipped back through it and I was like, oh my gosh, there's so many follow-up questions that I didn't get a chance to ask during that panel. And one thing that you mentioned was you talked about as a Scrum designer working with developers, that this actually helped you get to helped you communicate with them and help you get to a more user-centered database. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yes. And I was trying to remember how to describe this because I worked at Athena Health, which is a electronic health record and claim processing company.
Yes.
So very deep, deep complexity up in there. And the team I was on, we were, to simplify, we are responsible for onboarding new doctors. So with insurance companies and with hospitals. So, imagine that you are an administrator at a hospital, you just hired a new doctor. The system for adding that doctor, you had to fill out a form, that's who's this provider. But then if you wanted to add them to a department, which is very important so that they could schedule with patients, you had to go up back into the IA, find the department's page. You had to have added the provider first, and then you have to go and add them to the department's page later. And you just have to know to do that. So obviously this workflow had a lot of holes in it. Before I had OUX as a tool, I didn't even know about this department's workflow either. We were just told by our stakeholders we're trying to improve the provider ad, the doctor ad experience. But after I had OUX, I was able to look at the whole system of the connections between providers and departments and all these other things they needed to be connected to and see this is a big gap. And this is a big place where our data is getting messed up, where providers are being delayed for up to weeks to be able to see patients because they're not added correctly. So we were able to show that to our stakeholders, and my developers were immediately on board. They didn't know either that we were missing this connection between providers and departments. And we were able to redesign the workflow so that we could automatically just add the department to the provider from the provider ad kind of experience. So I did the OUX course relatively soon after I left Athena. So I didn't get like a ton of experience with those developers doing this, which I'm sad about because they were awesome and I would have loved to do it. But that was one example that it was just like so clear how valuable it was to everyone on the team. And they really liked doing the stickies and the, you know, diving into the database and stuff like that too.
That is okay. So I got to back up here for a second because I forgot that you were at Athena, and we have, I mean, Athena is very OUX-y. We like shout out to Athena. We've got a lot of love for Athena using OUX. But what year did you leave Athena?
It was, I think, 2020.
Okay.
During the pandemic, yeah. Or 2021.
So I did my first workshop at Athena in like 2016 or something. So was there already like, and maybe that was like another department or something like that, but like, is it absolute coincidence that like OUX is happening in other places in Athena and that you like came to OUX a little bit after leaving Athena?
I don't know. I got introduced to OUX by your presentation at Athena.
Okay. Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Cool. Okay. All right. I had to connect those dots for a second. Oh man, we got some history.
Yes.
We've been here a while. We've been here a minute. That's really cool. So one question that I just recently got actually in the OUX forum was how much should your object map align to the database? Like actually, like, is it a representation of the database? And my answer was like, it could be, but usually like I'm thinking about it from that user, when I'm working, I'm thinking about it from a user experience perspective, from a conceptual standpoint, and that then it could like inform a conversation with developers and potentially inform the database. When you were working with developers and you know, at Athena and also at Coforma, how much do you align like the object map that is the user experience versus the actual technical architecture?
I think I'm on the same page as you, where I maintain it as a UX artifact that informs the database. And I'm not even sure whether we were able to make database changes in that example I gave, or if we had to do some like workaround thing, because one of the challenges with large organizations is that our objects are connected to like a million different things. So making a database change might be impossible or really difficult, and then it'll impact like, you know, 10 other teams, 40 other teams, whatever. Yeah, that's my long answer to that.
I think it comes down to like, you need to like decide what the artifact is actually doing and communicate that clearly. Mm-hmm. Like I 100% think a developer team could use an object map to explore or represent their technical architecture, but that object map is going to look very different than there's probably a very good overlap, but it will look different than the object map that a user experience designer would create that is really just thinking about like, this is what the user sees, because there's going to be all sorts of objects that get created that are not user facing. And potentially like one of the conversations came up on like having like an object base with derived objects. So like showing a little bit of inheritance from a documentation standpoint, where the developer might not use that. Like the developer might not use inheritance in this scenario. They might not use a base. They might use some other complete method, and we're not. And it's just like really important to communicate that as we're working with developers. Like, I'm not telling you how to actually build the system, right? This is a way that we can kind of like a sort of a Rosetta Stone for us to come together and have a conversation about these technical implications that align to the user experience implications.
Yes. Yeah. I'm on the same page as well. And I think the object map documents the OUX, the architecture, and then also the content and the evolving dynamic content. And this is something we've seen at the VA, that our dynamic pages, we kind of struggle to document like a source of truth of the content of like, oh, if we're talking about you're submitting a claim to the VA for disability payments, our content team might be like working on that use case for the disability claim, but there's like 100 other claim types, and we don't know what all that content is and how it needs to be different unless we ask the developer to just like pull what's already been written. Sometimes they just like can't figure it out. So I think the object map can really help us stay on top of like, yeah, the full UX architecture and content of the system.
So you would have like a claim object that would have the multiple types and actually like, are you saying like actually looking at all that conditional logic of like if it's this type, then what actually changes so that you can design for those
Yes.
changes?
Yes.
Yes. Oh my gosh. Like I don't know how people do this without
I
like how do
know,
you
me
not
neither.
already UX? Like
Yeah.
when you have all that kind of conditional logic, when you have an object that has so many permutations, and you know, we talk about shapeshifters a lot and how we like shape-shifting is bad when it's unintentional, right? When you have two thing or you have a thing that can like look different in different places, that's bad to make that unintentional because there needs to be so much intentional shape-shifting, right? Like you
Yeah.
have this claim and like depending on what type it is, depending on if I'm like the veteran looking at it, and we're talking about the VA project, right? The Veteran Affairs Project. So,
Yes.
if I'm a, you know, a veteran that has signed, that is my claim, right? It's going to look one way versus, you know, a claim processor is going to see it potentially a different way. So there's like depending on what role is looking at it, depending on what stage the claim is in, depending on what type the claim is, you're going to have probably, I mean, potentially hundreds of different permutations, at least dozens,
Right.
right, in your case. And you don't want to have a bunch of unintentional shapeshifting because you want to make sure you're focusing on that intentional shapeshifting. You sort of have like every time it shifts around, it is going to be an increased cognitive load. So you don't want to add extra. And like that is like to be able to see all those permutations and to get that bird's eye view and be like, okay, how can we make this like the least effective dose of shapeshifting, which is going to save development effort, design effort, and like cognitive load too at the end of the day.
Right.
So shapeshifters, actually, so that segues into another thing I wanted to follow up with you on that you mentioned in the panel is that like we were, I think the question was something along the lines of like, what are the first little baby steps you can use to like get people excited about OUX or like to start like, you know, creating the appetite for it? And you talked about doing an unintuitive objects audit, like going through the system and showing all the shapeshifters and masked objects and broken objects and isolated objects. But we didn't actually follow through and like, I didn't get to ask you, how was that received? Like what came out of that audit that you presented?
Yeah, I think the way we approached this did really resonate with the team. Yeah, we basically did an audit of the existing claim status tool at the VA, to understand and of the danger zone, so mass objects, isolated, broken object, shapeshifters, and kind of showed examples of each of those danger zones. And I think the ones that resonated them, and some of them we were unsure. We were like, based on the artifacts we have, which is like a Figma file, plus like being able to log into staging, like in the environment, this is what we could see. And this is what we think might be a masked object or might be an isolated object. And we were able to have conversations with the team, and they would say, like, oh no, it's actually, actually there's this thing, but that's not documented anywhere, that has, that there's some reason for this. So it was a great way to have conversations about object-oriented UX without having to jump into the workshop, which be just because of my contract and where we're kind of at is just difficult. And I think the danger zone that most resonated with that team was isolated objects, because we have claims, but then you can appeal a claim. So say I submit a claim for disability for PTSD, and they're like, no, your PTSD is not connected to your military service. That probably doesn't happen a lot, but just go with me on this example. And I want to say, like, oh, actually, could you have someone else look at this? Because I don't think that's right. You can submit an appeal. But in our system, an appeal is like a separate object. And it's not connected to your original claim. So that is very confusing for people. The appeals are also called a bunch of different things. So we have some shape shifting just with the content that we use.
The labels.
Yeah, there's a lot of broken, the appeals themselves are kind of a little bit broken, but intentionally. So are they actually broken? But you can't like submit documentation or ask a question. Like there's not a lot you can do with them. So we were able to kind of walk the team through that. But I think one place where there's some hesitation still is our reliance as a UX practice on user research and wanting to say like, oh, well, users got it, or like users understood what this was. Even if we think like the underlying architecture could be better. So that's one of the hurdles that came out of that I'm continuously sort of thinking about.
That's really interesting. So one that's it's interesting that like I love that it's not just, hey, let me show you all this like, kind of a heuristic analysis of like, here's everything that's wrong with your design from an OUX perspective, which can be really powerful, right? That's a really powerful tool to use, is one of these audits, especially with those shapeshifters. And yeah, it sounds like for you, like the isolated ones too, was that really resonated as well with things that are connected conceptually were not connected in the actual experience. But then it was a conversation starter. And then it helped you get some questions asked or realize, like, okay, these two things look really similar in the system. Like, are they actually very similar? Because they look really similar. And then they can be like, oh, no, those are actually different things. Or actually, yeah, those are actually the same thing. They're just two different versions of the same thing, or there's like, some permutation of the same thing, or vice versa with the shapeshifters. Like these look like two different things. Are they? Are they not? Which is some of my, those are some of my favorite questions to ask early on is, are these two things the same thing? Are they different things? Okay, they're different things. Okay, how are they related? So it can help drive that like very the conversation that should happen really early on.
And as part of this, we sort of did an intro to OUX with that team. We talked just high level, like what are these danger zones? What are masked objects, isolated objects? Then we went off, we did our audit, we made a draft object map just in stickies, and then we went right to sketches. This was also just something I'm like experimenting with to show the team, like, okay, here's how we applied some of these. Here's how we like fixed, in air quotes, some of these problems, just as an example, like how it would look in the UI. I'm not sure how helpful that was. Maybe it was helpful, but
I think
there
so.
were places it was.
I mean, I've heard so shout out to Lauren Stone. Lauren Stone talked about this in her OUX happy hour. She was working at a healthcare company and talked about this sort of bottom-up approach of doing OUX. Like when you can't just go in and like do this full redesign and do all this like beautiful holistic thinking and create an object map for your existing system and your ideal system and your competitor and do all this analysis and all these this really, really helpful collaborative work. Sometimes your hands are just tied. And this kind of bottom-up approach of showing like, okay, here's where we potentially have some issues, and here's our fix. Here's how we can connect these two isolated objects, right? Here's how we can just simply link these two things together that were not linked before. Or here's how like this one thing shows up in six different ways. Like we could probably show this all the same way everywhere, and it's going to be, we're just going to be able to fix that. So like having that kind of bottom-up approach is, I think, just it's a great way to start, and it's a great way to sell the value of it.
And we were able to kind of pressure test too with some of our higher up stakeholders at the VA. We have the VA has a robust IA kind of strategy that we are working on and kind of implementing. Of course, I come in with OUX. I'm like, let's do it this way. So that's been kind of something I've been working on, how to make sure that the OUX work we're doing is fitting into the goals and needs of our kind of leader, our IA leadership. And from this process and kind of keeping our stakeholders looped in, we learned, oh, our IA leader is very bought into isolated objects and fixing isolated objects. So that's like information I gained to be able to move this work into other places of the VA. Maybe just focusing on isolated objects. Maybe that's all we have the kind of like political will to do. But even that would make a huge difference for
Oh,
veterans.
oh my gosh. I mean, like to be able to have that audit and to show where the interest is, not even show like this is where our big problems are and here's something, but like this is where the power within this organization is the most interested. Like it could be, it could very easily be shapeshifters, because it's like, ooh, like maybe that's something that like it's a money down the drain type of thing. But in your case, it was the isolated objects, right? And that really resonated. And that can, it's like, how do I get a foot in the door? And that tells me that like potentially, like if you get 1 hour to run a workshop, do a nested object matrix, right? Like do some system modeling, like really focus on the R of Orca, focus on the relationships there, because that's all about fixing those isolated objects.
Right. Yeah. At the beginning of my OUX journey, I always approach things of like, oh, well, let's do the workshop. Let's do like the full Orca workshop. And that's just really, the time is really difficult. And sometimes you just don't get the buy-in at that. Like not everyone is as jazzed about this, you know, as we are. I love OUX, and everyone I work with at the VA like knows how much I love it. But I think doing even just like one of these, just like you mentioned, like nested object, or maybe jumping right to the relationship guide, like it's okay to do just one thing. It's better than doing nothing related to OUX.
Yeah. And that is, I think that is what, like, when people go through the certification, that is one of the things that I'm trying to teach more and more of, is like, you learn this methodology, and then you take it out in the real world and you bend it and you break it and you take pieces of it and you mash it up with what you're already doing, and you create weirdo OUX-y site maps and like other kinds of artifacts that like that we're not taught in the course. It's just all these tools that can then go and support you out in the wild with all your, like, you know, with all the things that happen, all the messes that happen out in the wild. And now you just are more equipped to handle those messes. And that's like, that is the test of like really being like really a kind of being a more advanced OUXer, is being able to then bend and break and be like, ooh, like, you know what we really need here is my cat sitting fire department. Like, let's do it on this, on this one. And even just do it on these, like, this relationship right here really needs it. Like, or these three or four relationships. We don't need to do it on all of them, but just like these key relationships, let's really dig in. And I actually have a tool to put these under a microscope. And then knowing that that is the way, that is like, that is where the decision makers are the most interested, and it's going to resonate. And then you can kind of just go from there.
Yes. Yeah. And that reminds me of another example is, so I'm working on this. So this claim status tool thing, me and another coworker who's super into OUX are working on through the requirements round for this, which has been like really fun and very interesting. But we're working through the object guide. It's 22 pages long. One of our content colleagues who's like super overbooked all the time to like look through this for accuracy and kind of be on our same page. So we decided to get rid of a lot of the content that we figured that we didn't actually need. And so we got rid of success criteria, ownership, and we had added this ways it may do harm. We still filled out all of those things, but we decided like, okay, let's take this, put this in like a separate bucket that's like optional recommendations, focus on the things that like we really need to focus on. And so it cut the documentation in half that she had to look at.
Yeah. And I mean, that's like, every object guide is probably going to be different, and it's going to be even different object to object. You could have an object that you're like, okay, success criteria matters for this one object. Like, let's write it for this one object. And then the other ones don't need it. It's like continuously, like, I feel like my mantra for cohort 9 has been like, do what's useful. Like only do the parts that are useful. Also be open-minded about one thing that you might like not think is going to be useful, like writing purpose statements, right? Like sometimes it's like, oh, we know what the purpose of that thing is. We know why that thing is there. And then when you have trouble articulating it, you're like, ooh, actually, do we know? Do we actually know this? So balancing like a little bit of experimentation, a little bit of like keeping an open mind about it. And then also like, this is not serving us, so get rid of it and then add your own section to it, right? It's really all the object guide is it's a glossary that has multiple sections that you get to figure out what those sections are. And we teach you like 6 or 7 sections in the course. It's like, here's ones that are commonly helpful, but who knows what you're going to need.
And Yeah. And we ended up adding, I'm leading this, multi-month workshop, OUX workshop series at Coforma, where I'm basically walking through like Kristen's version of the course of, and we're doing Airbnb as our example, which has been like really fun.
Nice.
That we added to our object guide, this criteria that's ways it might do harm, which we love, you know, everyone at Coforma is like all about that. But that was super helpful and really interesting and engaged kind of what a lot of my colleagues are interested in is designing ethical, you know, in an ethical way, designing ethical tools and making sure, especially in the government situation, that we're thinking through these things and thinking through like, okay, we're building this object. How might that do harm to the public? Even if we think it would be really awesome for like this specific use case, could it cause different populations harm later? So we really like that one.
I love that one. And that is like, I mean, this is system thinking right here, but it's system thinking in a very systematic way where we can say object, not just like how this massive thing that we're putting out in the world. We can always say, how can that do harm? But then, or what is the purpose of that? Right. What good could it do? What bad could it do? We could do it at this like macro product or service level, but then when we go down, we can do that for our objects. You know, what's the purpose? Okay. What's the business purpose? What's the user purpose? But also, how could it potentially do harm? Why not do this actually? Like, is there any reasons we shouldn't do this actually? We can do that for relationships too. Connecting things.
Yeah.
There's major privacy issues sometimes with connecting things. If you show this thing on top of this thing, like who gets to actually see that those things are connected? Right. So like just an example, like connecting post to location, right? Like
right.
Connecting those two objects, like in a social media setting, like we need to think about that. Like, what is the privacy around that? Can users turn that off? Like, there's many reasons why we might not want to connect those two things.
Right.
And then, I mean, for CTAs, also we talk about like the why of the CTA. We could very well add a column over why not have this? Do we actually need a follow button on here? I'm using social media as an example, but like, is that really the kind of tool that we're trying to create? Like, do we need an upvote and a downvote on this, right? And then for attributes too, like every single attribute, we could question it and be like, is there any reason not to put this information out there?
Right. Yeah. And one example that comes up a lot for me is in government is connecting your tax information to other systems. Because a lot of people, if you're applying for benefits that are income-based, you have to provide like your income information, which if you're filing taxes, that's already in there. So a lot of people, you're having to duplicate that information. You have to get your taxes. You have to like fill it out again. And a lot of questions that come up are like, aren't you the government? Like, don't you know this information? Why do I have to enter it again? But a big reason is that privacy issue and wanting to make sure, like sometimes there's an important reason that agencies don't share information to protect our privacy as, you know,
yeah.
Citizens.
And then that's a great opportunity to bring UX writing in. Like, okay, so if these things are not connected, how do we communicate? Why? If they're connected in the mental model, right? If they're connected in the real world, this is how I think about these things. These things should be connected. And that's what people are going to do. If they're connected in their mental model, they're connected in the real world, they're connected in just truth about the world, then it's weird when they're not connected in the system.
Yeah.
But there might be a reason to not connect them because we've done our homework and we've just said like, why not do this? And maybe we left something intentionally unconnected. Then maybe we want to have some really good messaging around why it's not connected. So people understand and they're like, oh, okay, that makes sense.
Right. And building empathy and trust in our government is very important.
Trust. Yes. It's like, why does this not work? Because so many people, and I do want to get to that, that podcast, but to kind of segue into this, I think that they were saying, like that many people think that the government intentionally doesn't work efficiently, that there's like this almost like, it's like the conspiracy theory of like, oh, we want to make these things difficult so that people can't apply for services or they can't, you know, do these things. And in general, that seems from talking about people working in government and designers working in government, that is not true. So I wanted to ask you about that. So you popped a podcast recommendation over to me to listen to. And oh my gosh, it's so interesting. It's with Ezra Klein. What's the name of the podcast, actually? It's like,
oh gosh.
Ezra Klein's New York Times podcast. Yeah, that
yes.
one. And it's with Jennifer Palka. So you can start, we'll link it in the show notes. So Ezra Klein is interviewing. Oh my gosh, Jennifer Palka. Like, I think I got to meet her at a conference for a moment once, and I was just so starstruck. So she is she's the founder of Code for America, and has just done such amazing work in government. So I've been following her on and off. So I was super happy to listen to this interview, and there were certain things that definitely like resonated for me. But I'm curious, like, why did you recommend that podcast to me? Like, what resonated most for you from that conversation?
I think, so I'm very passionate about government and wanting to increase the, you know, the efficacy of government, make sure things are working. Obviously, we're in this big digital transition, and the US, compared to some other countries, you could say we're a little behind, or we're not doing our best at that work. And there's been, President Biden passed a like customer experience, you know, executive order, like we got to make our user experience better for our government services. So we're all working on it, but why isn't it awesome yet? Is a question that people often ask. And why are we still filling out forms that feel like they were designed in like 1998? Why aren't these things connected? Why are my taxes not connected to these other things? So there's a lot of questions around this. And I feel like Jennifer Palka really answers a lot of those questions in a way that resonated with me as someone in the system, especially the way that the government does contracting, I think is very, you might think it's boring, but it's actually very fascinating, I think.
And there's this, take us into the weeds, of government contracting.
Yes. And there's this movie, I think it's called War Dogs. Let me see. It's like a comedy. Okay. Yes. All right. So there's this movie called War Dogs with Jonah Hill. Uh-huh. It's a comedy, and it's about a true story of, weapons contractors that were just these like 20-year-olds that were like, hey, let's get into weapons contracting and make like $1 billion, kind of like abusing the system. So I highly recommend
Jonah Hill doing that.
Yes, it's very funny, but it's also based on a true story. And I highly recommend it to watch to learn about that. So there's reasons that government contracting is like very locked down, very kind of, there's just so many like rules, red tape, and guidelines around it that are good reasons for that. If you watch this movie, you will learn why there's good reasons. But part of the impact of that is that it makes it difficult for these large organizations like the VA to have a cohesive experience, because each contract is so narrowly focused. So my contract, for example, is very narrowly focused on content accessibility and IA for like the whole VA ecosystem. So we're like looking at that, but we are like absolutely not supposed to design products, you know? So when we're doing this OUX work, it's in that intermediate kind of space. Like we can only ever give recommendations. We can't like mandate that any other team does anything, which I'm not saying that if we could mandate that would like improve the situation, but that's just an example of how difficult it can be when you have many contractors with very narrow scopes of their contract trying to build something together and unable to collaborate organically, because we have to collaborate in this way that's been kind of set up from the beginning. Like our lanes are set up and we can't really like jump into each other's lanes very easily, depending on the folks that are surrounding those contracts and like how they're sort of managing it. So like the VA as an organization is not like AthenaHealth as an organization. It is a little bit like we both use Slack. We're okay. Like building products, but it's a very different environment, which I think Jennifer talks about in her podcast, and just, oh, it made it so clear to me because it is so challenging to work in this environment. And I felt very seen when she was talking about that.
I think she mentioned that like the healthcare.gov debacle, there was like 60 contracts out to build that. It wasn't just the one contract like imagining like that one experience divided up amongst 60 contractors, like no wonder. And like listening to that as well, and having worked in government and having experiences and being one of those contractors with a very tiny little sliver of what I was supposed to be working on, and just complete like lack of visibility into all the other pieces of it. It makes me think about how like government is almost like a caricature
of what is happening across our, across the technology industry. It's just like, you know, it's just amplified in government. The yak shaving and the silos are amplified. So like in enterprise, like very similar things happen where you have these siloed teams that aren't talking to each other, or you have siloed teams and then you have like multiple agencies and contractors coming in for different projects. And then often you'll realize like, oh, this project that I've been working on, this other department hired an agency to do the exact same thing that I'm doing. And we're just stepping on each other's toes and there's duplicate right. work happening. And then you also have like mergers and acquisitions. So then it's like the company that has literally bought 7 or 8 companies in the last year, and those companies are competing against each other. The products and the services are competing. And so you end up with like very similar, like different reasons for the problem, but very similar problems at the end of the day, where you have these silos and you have this kind of like the complexity is broken up in kind of a really inelegant way where creating any kind of holistic system is just almost like you're just set up to fail with it.
Right. Yeah. And I think I talked a little bit at the, what is the thing we did? Panel. About, yes. the panel about, shoot, now I'm forgetting what I was going to say. The other thing that's hard in addition to contracting, which is legislation. And the way, so legislation is passed and then the bureaucracy, so all the agencies have to implement the legislation, but they have to like follow the letter of the law exactly. So there's all these lawyers that are interpreting the law, and different laws might not work so well together once you get down to that implementation part. Yeah, it gets really tricky because when you think about, I think I talked about this at the panel, eligibility for benefits, every law that's released might talk about eligibility in a different way, might categorize people in different ways. So that when you're on the VA website and you're like, okay, I'm a veteran, what am I eligible for? There's no like search and filter of benefits by eligibility criteria because they all have these like different cross sections, which makes it difficult to do OUX because you can't have, our attributes are messy and we can't just make the decision to change them because it's like legislatively mandated to be a certain way.
And that gets to like this other parallel that I saw, that legislation or that requirements game of telephone that ends up happening, that it's like legislated to be a certain way, but nobody even like remembers why. Like it was like, right. Or it was like just a suggestion that somehow like that suggestion or that example got like the example that I'm thinking of in that podcast was the Raytheon example. Okay, whatever. I won't go into it, but like basically this idea that like we're supposed to use this certain type of software, and that was decided in like 1989 or something like that, and it's just got passed down to where all the contractors that were working on this project thought they had to use this antiquated software solution when there was absolutely no reason for it. Like it had just been this game of telephone, which is like similar to like these like laws. So I think that this is like another parallel that we have these, one, we've got these silos that somehow we need to break down. We need to kind of figure out like how, even if there are going to be these multiple contractors, how can the contractors start working together? How do we map out who's working on what? So at least we know who's working on what. And then also the requirements, where are these requirements coming from? Can we actually examine these requirements, ask why about these requirements? Right. And the same thing happens in enterprise organizations or any large companies where there's this game of telephone with the requirements and that separation, which I think you were alluding to, that Jennifer talked about, the separation of policy and implementation. It's like there's like the idea people or like the lawmakers, the policy people, and then there's the people that actually make the things. And there's a lot of separation between that. And we get that in large companies too.
Right. Yeah. And it's intentional. You know, the legislature and the bureaucracy are supposed to be kind of separate. It's like, you know, part of America, how our like government is designed. But yeah, I think this is something I'm really interested in, is other folks that can use OUX, which I think bureaucrats could really use this to understand, you know, we get a law passed down. OUX the law, like understand what the objects are, what the attributes are. Like, I think you could make an object map of a law that's passed down that needs implementation to better understand what we're actually doing, what we're actually implementing.
100%. I mean, this is a tool for understanding, right? So to, I mean, when Roe versus Wade was rolled back, was that just last year, 2 years ago? And it just was like,
year.
You know, blindsided me completely because I don't watch the news, and it just like came out of nowhere for me, even though I know it was not coming out of nowhere. But for me, it was like, what? And I OUX'd that. To be able to understand it, like, okay, what are the like, what actually is Roe versus Wade an instance of? like, is it a court case? Is it a law? Like, what is it? Is it a law and a court case that are? Is it statute? Like, wait, what are these things, and how do they all relate to each other? And are there like precedents, and like how do states, because there's like states versus. And then there's like even different types of abortion, and like, I mean, I mapped that shit out so that I could better understand what was going on. And it was so helpful. I mean, it was infuriating, but it was also really, really helpful to just help me like get a grasp. It was a little bit therapeutic too. I may just put it all in an object map.
I know. No, I feel the same. When I'm really overwhelmed by something, I'm like, oh, let's just do the object map. You should publish that. I feel like that would be really helpful for other folks to know. I don't know if it's a statute or a law or a case.
That's what got me down the rabbit hole. Is like, I don't even know what this is an instance of, like what Roe versus Wade. Like, I know it's a historical event, but like in this context, what actually is it?
Right.
Yeah. So like applying that to the law, applying that to policy, applying it to, you know, I mean, even like contractors, like, okay, the projects that you have and the contracts that you have, and we're all working on this project, like could OUX at least help you know who you need to talk to about something. Like, this thing does connect to this. You kind of own that object over there, but it shows up over here in my little locus of control. Can we get on a call? Can we talk about this a little bit, like what you're doing over there? And how can we sort of like just, smooth out those channels potentially through the magic of OUX and lots of other things. But I think OUX can help with both of those big problems of the silos and the requirements game of telephone too.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. We got through maybe a third of the questions that I had. we really wanted to play with OUXing voting. That would have been really fun. So,
oh my God, I do want to talk about that.
I know. We'll do it next time for sure. We'll have you back on and we'll talk about, we'll just like OUX the government. On the podcast.
I really want to talk about that. I know. I also wanted just to give a shout out to all the folks working in government, whether you're designers or not. It is not easy, and it is a service for people that live in America. And I just appreciate everyone that's in the bureaucracy and the legislature that's just like really trying to improve things. And I hope that we can, I hope that OUX can help us as a community.
Yes. Oh my gosh. I echo that. I echo that 100%. All the yak shaving that you have to do to get the thing done. I absolutely salute all of you working in it. And I want to do more of this too. I would love to get some more projects where I'm helping out government agencies. The work that I got to do with the National Park Service was absolutely
so cool.
Amazing. Like, would love to do some more with those folks. So National Park Service, if you're listening, call me. but just so much cool work to be done. And I also think, like, for those that might be thinking, oh my gosh, like, do I want to get into that? Like, seems like I don't want to scare anybody away from going into government, like these conversations that we've been having. I mean, it sounds like it's been really rewarding for you. And also, like, what an amazing place to be where so much change can happen, right? Like, so much work needs to be done. Like, do you really want to work for a company where everything is all slick and shiny already?
Right.
That seems kind of boring, actually.
Yeah, I love these problems. I've been into forms since I was a wee lass, so love being able to do this.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Kristen, for being here. This is a great conversation. Cheers. Happy OUXing.
Thank you so much for listening. I truly hope you enjoyed this episode. Please visit objectorientux.com/podcast for show notes. Our soundtrack is Fighter by Ruby Vell, courtesy of Sugaroo Records. Happy OUXing!